Hello, I'm Ross Camage, and welcome to How This Is Building Me, a podcast focused on the highs and lows, ups and downs of all those involved with cancer, cancer medicine, and cancer science. And my guest today is somebody that I had dinner with at a faculty dinner at a conference last year, and I had such a wonderful time. I really felt I wanted to share that experience with a wider audience. So without further ado, my guest today is Dr. BJ Reimel. BJ, would you care to introduce yourself in any way you see fit?
Sure, happy to. So my name is BJ Reimel. I am a gynecologic oncologist, a parent of two children, and a queer gynecologist.
There we go. I do love the kind of like, let's forget the foreshadowing. Let's just jump in there. Let's start with the most important question. So what does BJ actually stand for?
It stands for Bobby Joe, which is not a name that I use. And everyone always asks, how did you get such a name? And I came by it very naturally. In my family, we had Mary Jo, Betty Jo, Peggy Jo, Sarah Jo, and I got Bobby Jo.
And you grew up in the Waltons.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
My parents hail from the middle of the country in Missouri. And this was a very normal thing for people to have names like this. But when I traveled around the country, it became a little bit of a cross to bear. And so I stopped using it pretty quickly. Well, actually, as a teenager.
We touched on this when we chatted on the phone the other day. You had a pretty widespread childhood. You know, you traveled around a lot.
Yes. My dad was in the military. We moved every couple of years. And I've had the privilege of living in residence in 17 of our 50 states.
That's pretty amazing. So home now is California. You now work at Cedars-Sinai in LA. But where do you consider you grew up, or you grew up in a trailer or in the back of the car?
I have lived in a trailer many times. I don't really consider any particular place as like a home. I moved too often to really have a connection. Living in California actually for the last 12 years is the longest I've lived in any place my whole life. I don't really feel like I have a home. I really grew up mostly on the East Coast and in the Southern states. I lived in Alaska for some time and I lived in Texas for some time, but most of my upbringing years were on the East and South.
When did the idea of becoming a physician turn up in your life? Is there a family of physicians? It's a military family by the sound of it.
Yeah, no, I'm the first person to hold a graduate degree in my family. My father, as I mentioned, was in the military. When he got out of the military, he became a Southern Baptist preacher. And my mom was a school teacher, taught mostly English, but we moved a lot. So she was mostly a substitute teacher. I really wanted to be a doctor. I remember sitting in my ninth grade English class. Mrs. Fulkowski was my ninth grade English teacher. And Mrs. Fulkowski was my first experience with a chain smoker. And I would watch her go out the back door and turn a little bit grayer and a little bit bluer towards the end of that cigarette. And then she'd come back in and kind of pink up on her way back in. And I thought that was so fascinating what was happening to her. And I really liked her. She's a great teacher. And I remember asking her, like, why do you smoke? And have you talked to anyone about it? And maybe you should not smoke because you get a little gray when you go outside. And she said to me, you know, of all the people that have asked me this, you're the first person that I would actually tell the truth to. And I, you know, learned a little bit about her. And by the end of English that year, I said, you know, I think I want to be a doctor. And Mrs. Fulkowski said, you know, I think you could do it. And she didn't say it like, oh, you're so wonderful. She just thought very practically. And I remember thinking that that was the first time anybody encouraged me to do something other than grow up to be someone's wife.
I love that. I didn't want to pry into her details, but why did she explain why she was smoking?
Her mother had and her aunts had, and it was just something everybody did, and it seemed so appropriate. It was a part of her growing up and cultural norm, I guess, is what we would say now. Back then, it was just like it's what everyone did.
Did she use the word addicted or needed?
No.
Nothing.
No.
It was just like, it's just a fashion in my family.
Pretty much. I mean, she was like, you know, one of those teachers that everybody loved. She was so talented. She really brought the work to life, you know, but she was different from our teachers in that she, you know, had to leave class to go smoke outside the door. And her room was at the end of the hallway so that she had the closest route to the back door.
I love that. Pragmatic. So one of the things, you know, I still get to somebody the other day, I think they're a research coordinator, and they're going like, oh, no, I remember it was an x-ray technician. And it was like, you know, how do you become a doctor? And, you know, how do you end up a specialist? And I always tell people that the first decision you make is whether you want to be a surgeon or not, which I decided not, because I actually faint at the sight of blood. And that's in a kind of abstract sort of way. You know, if like there's a bucket of blood that's just spilling, especially if it's my blood, I pass out. It's like a possum response. But, you know, I was a functional physician because, you know, if there's an emergency, you've got a job to do. It was just blood in the abstract was a bit weird for me.
Got it.
I mean, maybe that same decisive thing where, you know, with your English teacher, which is like, I'm just going to address it head on. Like, okay, I'm going to be a surgeon.
I decided I want to be a surgeon when I sort of failed as a pathologist. So I did a year of a pathology fellowship in the middle of medical school at Yale, and I got to work in the morgue. And I loved being there, and I loved doing autopsies, and I loved solving the mystery. But the part that I really, really liked was the getting your hands dirty, getting into the mix of it, doing the sampling, doing all of the dissections. I thought that was fascinating. And I thought I really wanted to be a pathologist. But then, like, the pathologist wouldn't even show up until the samples were, you know, tiny little blocks, and we looked at them under the microscope, and then I kind of lost interest.
You were a macroscopic pathologist.
I was definitely a macroscopic pathologist. I mean, the most fascinating things that I saw were things that I could diagnose by looking at them without the microscope. So for me, I realized I really liked working with my hands. And so I actually had to pivot, because I had really set myself up to be a pathologist, to something else. And so, yeah, and I ended up in OBGYN also in a kind of a strange way, because you think you just go straight to surgery. But the surgery rotations I got assigned were vascular surgery, and they made me carry a leg after an amputation down to the pathology department because I knew where it was.
Did you do that discreetly, or is it just over your shoulder? I mean,
no, it was discreetly, and it was wrapped and everything. But I remember thinking, like, this is not the right job for me. Like, that I'm really not amongst my people, and I didn't feel connected to the work, which is not intended to be a pun. And so anyway, I really liked interacting with women, which is really working for me. So I really liked operating on women, and OBGYN was a sure thing that your patients would primarily be female. So I really started doing that work and really liked it.
So I saw in your CV that you performed over 200 adult and pediatric autopsies in a year.
Yes.
That seems like a lot, because my understanding, no pun intended, is that autopsies are a dying specialty. That was actually a deliberate pun, I've got to tell you. That was, I've been saving that one up.
I'm proud of you for it. That was quite delightful. Yes. So I really, really loved that job, and I loved the opportunity to do something very unique. And at the time that I was doing it, I recognized that there were very few people that still knew the difference between a Rokitansky dissection versus, you know, like I knew that this was going out of fashion.
Yeah, because I have no idea what you just said.
Right. Yeah. So I realized that knowing that these were different kinds of things and they were not going to be around forever, the potential that people were simply going to lose these techniques was high. And there was at that time, to my knowledge, no written atlas for the procedures that we did for autopsies. And they were passed down through oral tradition, at least in the place where I was working. And so my project, my thesis project for that year, was actually to create an online atlas, like a visual representation with video and pictures of, you know, autopsies, so that people would know how to go backwards and do them, especially for very complex fetal and neonatal autopsies that at the time that we were doing them were very valuable for families trying to understand what was the next step for them in terms of, you know, trying to, you know, to understand what had happened during that reproduction and how they could potentially avoid or earlier diagnose something for the next pregnancy. So I found that very moving, and I really liked it.
I mean, I can see how there are dotted lines between that and at least the OB part of OBGYN. Again, imagine that I'm completely ignorant of almost everything below the diaphragm. But when you go into OBGYN, again, is there a natural separation between those who want to be OB and those who want to be gynae? Or does everyone start off pluripotential and stay that way?
That is such a good question, and something our specialty is actually struggling with. OBGYN is pushed together because the care of women kind of gets pushed to one side and has had structural systemic sexism as it's forming powers. But there are definitely people that go into OBGYN who really, really love pregnancy and babies, and they end up being primarily obstetricians. And then there are people that really, really love operating on women for reproductive care and end up being some version of a gynecologist, whether a benign gynecologist or somebody like me who does mostly cancer surgery.
I'm not going to let you get away with your throwaway line about what's systemic sexism. So can you expand on that?
So systemic sexism is not something that I can define as well as people who've studied it for many generations, right? But the point is that the care of women has historically been relegated to a few people, right? Other women, midwives, secret societies of people that owned the forceps, all the crazy things that women have been subjected to. And so OBGYN had been recognized sort of the way that we think of these systems and their functions, maybe would have actually been a field of obstetrics and a field of GYN, rather than kind of mushing them together, being like, well, they're all ladies.
Do you have any idea in the sort of current classes coming through what the mix is between male and females who are now graduating versus historically?
So historically, like all medical specialties, they were primarily male. But now most OBGYNs that are graduating are primarily identifying as female. The number of people who identify as male going into OBGYN is pretty low. I'm not sure what the exact percentage is, but like in our own residency here at Cedars-Sinai, we only have 3 men out of a class of 24.
Do you find that varies internationally?
I don't know that I know the answer to that. It might.
I mean, because if you think about, you know, I was, you know, Googling like you do, and I was Googling back in the 80s and 90s. And for me, it doesn't feel that long ago, but it's 30 years ago. And some things in terms of, you know, what was perceived as acceptable in terms of, you know, racial, sexual, whatever, humor, utterly changed. And so one wonders if, you know, not every country is moving either in the same direction or certainly at the same speed as the USA.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. I don't know as many women gynecologic oncologists internationally as I know men gynecologic oncologists internationally, but I don't know if that's just my sampling error or something that's actually real.
So you finished fellowship, and it looks like your first, you know, attending position is at Cedars-Sinai. Yeah, it looked like you went from like Missouri to like California. Go on, explain that. I was just like, hey, sure, why not?
Well, that's easy to explain. So I got married when I was a resident in Chicago to my very beloved wife, and she went to WashU for law school. And so then I tried to get a fellowship position at WashU and was lucky enough to obtain one. And after a few years of living in St. Louis, Missouri, we did not want to live in a red state, for lack of a better term, anymore, and actively sought to find ourselves a welcoming environment. In fact, we looked at many different locations to try to find something that was appropriate for us, where we would have the rights and privileges that we felt were really important. For example, when we moved to California, the federal protection for same-sex marriage did not exist. And we couldn't be sure that the child that we had made would actually be able to legally be ours, both of ours, depending on what state we were in. And so things like second parent adoption were really important to us. And so California was a natural choice. So when it became available, we immediately moved to Los Angeles, and we've really never looked back.
You know, I was thinking about this, you know, again, with that kind of, with the retrospective scope, is so same-sex marriage became federally legal under Obama. Is that correct, or am I?
No, I think that's correct.
But before that, it was state by state.
Mm-hmm. And California was one of the early adopters.
Silly questions. Who proposed to who?
I proposed to my wife every day for 3 years while we were brushing our teeth. Very not romantic. I was not successful for a really long time, and I think I just wore her down.
Yeah. Just like, stop proposing. Yes. Oh, for goodness sake. All right. You know.
Yeah. Every day I would say, we should get married. And then I put my toothbrush down and look at her, and she would say, no. And then when she relented, and I don't know, I think I was really shocked, and so was she. I think she just wanted to see what would happen. And then, anyway, that was a long time ago. We've been together since 2002 and married since 2006.
And I think you told me this, you have a 16-year-old daughter and a 12-year-old son.
Correct.
And then, you know, you're in the situation where, you know, is this adopted? Did you carry? If you carried, how do you arm wrestle as to who carries or not?
Right. So it's great that you ask these questions, because I'm going to give you the response I give everybody, which is, it's so interesting that you would ask me that question and that I get asked who carried, how did you choose, tell me all about your reproduction, in a way that, like, heterosexual couples, like, they don't generally ask, like, how did you conceive? What day was it? What was your partner wearing? Like, it's a different feeling. So I always feel a little embarrassed. Like, if I say yes, that I did it, does that mean I'm, like, not the cool one? I did do it, for the record. I carried both children. My wife is not gender conforming, so that was just not a place of comfort for her. And I had better insurance, so I was definitely going to be the one to...
You're right. I think when we prepped for this conversation, I said, I'm going to, within the limits of not being too prurient, you know, I'm going to ask some dumb questions. But it, ironically, actually, I do, because I have patients who have, you know, cancer, who've been alive for a long time, and we become interested in pregnancy and lung cancer. And so I do end up asking these kind of, you know, weird questions as to how it was conceived, and, you know, were things banked and, you know, withdrawn from the bank. And for the men, there's the sort of walk of shame of, you know, they're heading down to bank some sperm and everybody knows what they did when they're walking back, you know.
It's true. And I don't actually mind talking about it. It's just one of those times where I like to point out that there's some disparity in, maybe not everybody would answer, and it's okay if they don't want to. But I'm very happy to tell you.
Well,
I'm very proud of my children.
No, I can tell, and rightly so. So one of the things is, when I asked you to introduce yourself, you hesitated a wee bit, and yet you still did decide to say, okay, you know, I'm a queer gynecologist.
Yes.
So you're right. It is a two-tier system. I don't have to announce my sexuality, because there's an assumption which I'm hiding under that I don't have to explain. But that's also a decision by you, you know, maybe, as we have seen examples before, to just go, look, okay, enough pussyfooting around. I'm just going to say this, you know.
Yes. I feel like I really did not have a lot of outwardly queer, outwardly gay mentors when I was coming up as a young medical student, resident, or fellow. And I felt very alone for a big chunk of my medical training. And there were questions or situations that would arise where I felt really out of my depth, and I didn't have a lot of people to talk to, or any people to talk to. And so part of the reason that I feel so forward about it now is because I want my trainees to know. And I also find that I can be helpful to the system just by being a little bit more public about something. I just feel like it's something that I'm comfortable with, that I'm happy to talk to people about. And sometimes it opens the door for patients to find me or find a safe space.
Yeah. And I actually think that's pretty incredible. I think the best people are the people who've had not great experiences, who then try and correct that wrong within the abilities that they have. Is it natural for you? Are you a natural, outgoing, look at me kind of person?
Somewhat. I think that I've learned as a physician that there's some elements of performance art in what we do.
I've never heard it described quite that way.
I don't know. I really feel that way, that there's a definite...
You're in Hollywood, though.
I am in Hollywood. And so I'm definitely dealing with performers a lot. But I do feel that in order to be the very best version of a physician, I am trying to present my authentic self, but also, like, all the people that have come before me that have trained me to, like, take that pause and listen a little bit longer, or ask that question a little bit differently when I don't think that the answer was exactly what I was looking for. You know, all those things are a little bit art rather than science. So I don't know, I think of it as performance art.
So tell me about being in CSINAC. My impression, again, this is, you know, from the outside, so correct me, is it's this composite of, you know, doctors like Michael Jackson's doctor, you know, the concierge to the stars, and then like real people and real doctors. How true is that?
I don't think Michael Jackson's doctor ever worked here, first
okay.
of all.
Okay, sorry, sorry. I do apologize to Cedar Sinus for that slur.
I really don't want Cedars to come and be like, oh my God, did you endorse that? No, I absolutely love working here, which I would say to anyone, there is mostly academic faculty. Like, we're mostly just regular science types, just the same as you'd find at, I don't know, Stanford or Harvard or Pittsburgh or wherever. I mean, we're kind of the same people. I will say that in Los Angeles, all the doctors look very young and beautiful because it's part of the cottage industry here.
So if you were old and ugly like me, I wouldn't get a job there. Is that sounds tremendous. I was intimidating before, but now you've just made it even more intimidating.
It's a thing. I don't know. It's definitely like whenever I go to a conference, I'm like, wow, like Cedars is a really weird place. Or maybe LA is a really weird place. It's great. I love it. I do see famous people all the time, but I see them at the Trader Joe's just as much as I see them at work. So kind of
what are they working at the Trader Joe's in between movies? Or are they actually shopping there?
No, but I did meet somebody that ended up on a show I watched a lot. They used to serve me pancakes at a diner I liked. So
there you go.
You never know.
It's another world. One of the things I saw in your CV, which made me, you know, kind of raise my eyebrows, is an award you got at Cedar Sinai for the most surgeries performed in a year, which is like, is that a good thing or a bad thing? Is like, you know, Dr. Reimel is the drive-through of gynecological oncologists. You know, I can get 300 through in a day.
Very kind of you to notice that award. The underneath the line that says the most surgeries, it's the most house staff surgeries. So I really, really love doing work for free. No, I really love taking care of anybody who comes my way. And it's a privilege to get to do the most pro bono work for a year. And I was very honored to be awarded that year.
That makes a lot more sense. Because as opposed to just kind of like, hey, we can get through. It looked like it's the Los Angeles Free Clinic, or is that a separate thing?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, the Cedars-Sinai residency, the OBGYN residency, used to work at LA Free Clinic. We have modified the resident clinic now, and they actually work at Planned Parenthood, where I got to work for a while as well. So Planned Parenthood of Santa Monica is staffed by Cedars faculty and residents, and is just the most amazing connection between community healthcare and an academic institution I've been able to see. I thought that was really, really fun to work there.
Do you know what it suddenly made me think of is the Barbie movie? Did you see the last scene in the Barbie movie? It's clearly filmed in Santa Monica. And she goes and she says, I'm going to see my gynecologist. Were you proud of that moment?
I thought it was sort of odd, to be honest, that the last thing that she wanted to do was prove to everyone that she needed a gynecologist.
Well, I loved it. It was actually the end of the movie I really liked, but I guess you might view it through different lens.
I thought the whole movie was a little bit hard to follow, but I really did like several sections of it. The gynecologist shout out is always a plus, but...
All right, so one of the things I told you I was going to give you a hard time over was the gynecological oncologist as the complete cancer physician. You know, you can do the surgery, you can do the chemotherapy, you can do the clinical trial. Do you even do any kind of radiation? Do you implant brachytherapy or anything?
No, we don't. We have somebody for that. But yeah, we have to learn about it enough to pass our boards.
So there aren't that many specialties that still combine the medical oncology stuff with the surgery stuff. So you had this very cool, you know, explanation for why it was, but maybe you can share that.
Sure. So gynecologic oncology started in the 1950s with a bunch of gynecologists who were advocating for their patients who were not receiving surgical debulking for reproductive cancers because at that time they were felt to be too fragile, that the removal of their uterus, tubes, and ovaries would make them less feminine, and that they essentially just weren't good candidates for active treatment. At the time, and these gynecologists, all of the men, decided that they were quite capable of operating on women and getting them through these complex surgeries and had the skills required to provide gynecologic cancer care. And then as it evolved, the first solid tumor to be treated effectively to cure with chemotherapy was actually gestational trophoblastic disease, which is disease of the placenta, which was also very OBGYN focused, right? Sort of the marriage between obstetrics, gynecology, and cancer. Yep. And so becoming really savvy with how to treat that became part of gynecologic oncology. And it just sort of continued to evolve that the structures that were limiting women's opportunities to, who had reproductive cancers to access care, but they were able to have that care provided by this gynecologist who took on specialized training and continued to educate themselves and kind of keep the fire burning for systemic cancer treatment, really kept going. Now, when they were doing it, they were doing like maybe four or five different types of surgeries and had one or two types of chemotherapy to deliver. So it wasn't actually that unrealistic for them to do. Now we're facing a situation where they're like probably 30 surgeries, some complex, some not too complex, that we would be required to know and be proficient at. And simultaneously, surgery is no longer just one platform, the open procedure. Now we're doing laparoscopic procedures, robotic procedures, minimally invasive single orifice surgeries, et cetera, et cetera. Plus, we have now immunotherapy, targeted therapy, complex radiation to deliver, proton beams, like who knows what we're really trying to tackle here. So I do think that we're coming to a point in our evolution that we're going to have to decide, how can one person be everything to everyone in gynecologic oncology? And I don't know what the right answer is. I'm still trying to do it all. And I still think there's some magic to being able to watch your patient from diagnosis to hopefully cure, but often to death, and being with them every treatment and every surgery and everything. Those relationships are unimaginably beautiful in the scope of what we get to do. And I feel very privileged to be a part of that. It would be sad for me to lose that connection if all I did was the mechanical stuff of surgery.
There are analogies with other tumor types. So, you know, I'm a thoracic oncologist. And when I was growing up as an oncologist, there were pulmonologists who gave chemotherapy. And they sort of got grandfathered, grandmothered in, mostly grandfathered, and they got to play it out. But gradually, they weren't replaced by other pulmonologists who gave chemotherapy. They were replaced by a medical oncologist who worked with the pulmonologist. And the same, actually, in Britain, where I grew up, there was, you know, clinical oncologists gave both radiation and chemotherapy for a whole range of different cancers. And then gradually, the medical oncologists hived things off. So I kind of agree with you that there's a trajectory that one can see. But for an individual physician, you may be able to work through the whole of your career without that having to sort of be dismantled whilst you're actually still doing the job.
Yeah, I hope not, because I only really know how to do this.
What proportion of your time is spent operating versus systemic therapy stuff?
I might be a little bit unique, but I operate one full day a week. I do about five big cases a week. And then I've got two full clinic days and research days and clinical trial days. So that's basically what my week looks like. So I guess I'm operating maybe a fifth of my week.
And then do you get a feel for what other gynecological oncologists are doing around the country?
Yeah, I think that some of my colleagues are definitely doing just surgery or mostly just surgery. Some institutions are doing where the gynecologic oncologist does the primary debulking, but then gives primary chemo, but then all recurrence is sent off to the medical oncologists. It just really depends on the unit. It's a little bit regional here on the West Coast. Everybody in LA is doing all of it all the time. When I was in St. Louis, they were doing all of it all the time. But then I have friends in Boston who just operate.
Let's segue into the clinical trial space, because that's one of your newer grand titles. You didn't list it at the beginning. You listed all of the nicer ones. But you're now the director of the whole of clinical trials at CDIS?
I'm the medical director of the clinical trials office.
And what delights come along with that title?
Yes. Well, they give you an executive physical, which is pretty great.
That sounds like a terrible thing. By the way, now we're just going to examine you, see if you're physically fit enough for the part.
Pretty much. What I get to do in that role is I get to oversee the clinical trials operations from the medical standpoint, from the clinician view, for the whole of Cedars-Sinai Cancer. I report to the assistant director for clinical research, which is Karen Redkamp. And then I have an administrator who is my partner in crime, who is doing sort of the administrative and managerial stuff for the clinical trials operations teams, like the CRAs and CRCs.
Why did you take it on? Because they asked you.
I begged them. No,
no. Will you marry me? You ask them every day for 3 years.
Yeah. That's pretty much my brand. So I really, really, really wanted this job. And the reason that I wanted it is I have had the privilege of being a little bit alone during clinical trials in juvenile oncology, but that has allowed me these sort of insights into how my system is working and all the things that I've had to do to get my trials open. And how I've had to adjust things to find patients or to locate the right kind of patients to eliminate disparities. And I really wanted to see some of these things that I learned play out in a larger field. And I've been here a long time. I've been here 12 years, which has afforded me some institutional memory. And I really felt like I could do this and I could make it better. And they let me after really like asking and asking and asking.
When did you start the job?
I was notified on New Year's Eve of 2022.
And then is it kind of like, you know, you buy a new house and you can spot all of the errors and you just have to write a list of things I want to fix and then work through them? Or is your day kind of like you come in and go like, I have a clean calendar and that is like problems start arriving?
It's mostly like that new house analogy. So it's a system, right? So it's not perfect. There's always things that are a little bit off or something needs to be tweaked, or this one study has like uncovered a whole host of things that are necessary and needed, but we've never done before. We need to fix them, you know, like cellular therapy. Lord have mercy. That is really hard to get going.
Yeah.
But it's the wave of the future and we have to know how to do it and we need to figure it out. And it's worth the investment to get that one study that's going to sort of break it open so that we can get more and more of that therapy to our patients. So I really enjoy that stuff.
So BG, one of the other things I know about you is you've developed a sort of auxiliary interest in cancer-related issues in the transgender community. Do you want to explain why you're interested in that and how it's grown over the years?
As a member of the LGBT community, it started as word of mouth. So I was one of the queer people at parties you could approach and say, hey, will you do my hysterectomy? And I could say, yes, yes, I will. I'd be happy to. And so the whole process really started for me right as I became an attending physician, with people needing trans or queer focused care. And I was very happy to see everybody. And then those types of surgeries and the types of patients that I started to see became more and more. And over the years, I realized I'm really seeing a lot of patients in the trans community and in the LGBTQ community. And I really am able to see and understand better what I'm missing, right? So I have people coming to see me that have never had a pelvic exam because they've never had a provider that was able to do it, or they haven't been screened for HPV, or they haven't been vaccinated for HPV because they didn't think they could get it. And finding that those are great opportunities for me as a gynecologic oncologist to intervene with education or opportunities for screening in a culturally sensitive environment, or offer alternatives to traditional screening like self-sampling for HPV. And that's really become something that I'm really, really focused on in my work now. About a third of my surgeries are actually transgender surgeries for patients that are looking to have complex pelvic surgery or minimally invasive gynecologic surgery for their transitions. And it's something I'm really passionate about.
I read an article by you, which was eye-opening for me. I think one of the things that you try to hit home is if you're born with a cervix, you don't need to have encountered a penis to get HPV, which is exciting because I've never said the word penis on air before.
Yes, that is correct. It does not take interaction with another gender or another sex to actually transmit HPV. And it turns out that any sexual contact, oral, anal, hand, doesn't matter, can actually transmit HPV, which is why condom use or interacting with a penis isn't necessarily the inciting factor for HPV transmission in the LGBTQ community. So it can be, but it doesn't have to be. And there is a lot of myths in my community about, oh, well, I'm a gold star lesbian. I've never done that with anybody. So then people had never been screened, but it had 15 partners and could have gotten HPV anywhere along the way. And those are the kinds of things that I think were really impactful in trying to help people understand that if you have a cervix, you should screen it.
During gender affirming surgery or transgender surgery, for people who are transgendering to a male role, the cervix goes away, or is it still there in some people?
So for folks that are transitioning from assigned female at birth to a more masculine gender that wish to have their uteruses removed, we remove the cervix as well. The cervix doesn't have a purpose without the uterus. And for the purposes of removal, most of the patients that I am taking care of are planning to have genital surgery to create a phallus. And in those settings, we need to remove the cervix because it produces mucus that can interfere with the creation of the phallus.
BJ, this is as fascinating a conversation as we had over dinner that time. I think you're amazing. I think what you're doing is amazing. But over the next 5 years, what does BJ Reimer want to do as a person and professionally as well? And you can put that in either order.
Personally, I think it's the harder one to answer. I have two kids and I really, really want them to be independent, driving, competent, joyful people. That is my goal. So I'm putting a lot of energy into that over these next few years because my kids aren't going to be in my house too much longer. That's my most important personal goal. I also hope to stay married. I'll put that in there.
Just keep asking every day, you know.
Can we stay married?
Can we stay married? Yeah.
And then professionally, in 5 years, I would love to see some of the work that we've been doing in clinical trials really translate to a larger number of the people in LA having true access and enrollment onto clinical trials that are relevant to them. That is really important to me. LA has been a miracle to me. I have never felt so loved and appreciated. I've never felt so normal as I do in Los Angeles, where I'm never the craziest person I meet. I just really love this city and I want to give back to it by hopefully giving these opportunities to the patients that need them.
I love it. BJ, thanks for sharing your time with us.
Thanks, Ross.
You've been listening to How This Is Building Me with me, Ross Kamage. Rate us and review us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, or follow us at DrKamage on X for additional commentary.